This is WMRA's Second Look, a look back at some of the stories and conversations from the WMRA newsroom. I'm Bob Levicky.
I'm not really a crier. I'm tough, but I've been broken. So that's my heart that I've cried out.
Sarah Blackwell has a heart-shaped tattoo at the corner of her right eye, symbolizing the tears she has shed over the years. She's homeless, and there are many reasons for that, but as Carol often reported, she's living on faith. We met her this week as our series on homelessness continues. We also go a little farther back into the archives with two stories by Andrew Jenner that each reflect distinct sides in the debate over the proposed Dominion pipeline, and we've got this week's installment of The Spark. Stay tuned for Second Look. This is Second Look, a look back at some of the stories and conversations from our newsroom this week and even a little farther beyond. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. We'll review two stories representing two sides in the debate over the proposed Atlantic Coast Pipeline, and we've got this week's installment of The Spark later on. But first, WMRA's Kara Lofton brought us the story of Sarah Blackwell this week. Sarah has struggled with disability, physical abuse, and drug addiction since she was a teenager. Through it all, she's relied on her faith. It's the fifth installment of our series on homelessness.
At the corner of Sarah Blackwell's right eye, a small heart is tattooed like a perpetual tear.
I'm not really a crier. I'm tough, but I've been broken. So that's my heart that I've cried out. And I love everyone. I'm very loving, and I really think that we all worked a little more as a team, and we all realize that we are brothers and sisters, and we've got to stick together, and when one of us falls, we've got to help each other out.
Sarah and her two children, a 12-year-old boy and a 15-year-old girl, are three of the 78 people staying at Valley Mission in Stanton. Although currently sober, Sarah struggles with chemical dependency and a diagnosed disability. Her husband, to whom she has been married for 16 years, is serving time in jail for failing to pay child support from a previous relationship. For Sarah, life has seesawed between self-sufficiency and succumbing to her addictions and disabilities. Staying at Valley Mission gives her the time and space she needs to stay sober and figure out her next step. Sarah's faith is very strong, and throughout our conversation, she repeatedly emphasizes how much she believes that what she is going through is a test of faith. If she stays faithful, Jesus will see her through her struggles.
My father was a preacher, a Christian. We're believers. I lived in a church.
And then the church closed down for reasons unknown to Sarah. Perhaps the church caught wind of her father's physical abuse toward his family. Her mother left her father when Sarah was 16 and took Sarah and her sister with her. It was at this point that Sarah first started getting into drugs.
I was already a little wild and kind of a runaway. Got in some trouble, met back up with my dad, went to a place called the Christian Training Center, got my GED, tried to get my life on the right track, went back to doing drugs. That's when methamphetamines really came in the picture. So I was dibble-dabbling with that.
At 18, Sarah took a Greyhound bus from Florida to North Carolina to live with a boyfriend who was also abusive. She left him soon after arriving in North Carolina, though, to be with the man who is now her husband. He introduced her to cocaine. At 20, she was married and pregnant, and she was able to stay off drugs for the duration of her pregnancy. Shortly after her daughter was born, though, she began to use again. In an effort to remain sober, she and her husband moved back to Florida to live with Sarah's parents, who had reunited. The move helped, and both Sarah and her husband were able to remain sober through Sarah's second pregnancy and the birth of their son. For the first time in her life, Sarah had a stable home and was financially comfortable. It lasted 3 years. Slowly, she said, the drugs began to creep into her life again. Within 3 months, everything they had built was gone, including her husband. Sarah said she still loves him, but it is harder to remain sober when he is around, and so they have been split up for some time, although they remain legally married. Sarah is now 36 and said she lives day to day. She said the hardest thing about her addictions is the desire to provide for others, including her children, and yet barely being able to support herself.
Everybody's just asking what's wrong with me. Why was I the drug addict? Why was I the one that was abused? A lot of these people, we see women with different baby daddies. Why didn't just one baby daddy love me? Why did I have to keep searching? What was wrong with me? You know, that the one person that I love that I decided to have children with, all of these things. My kids are, they both have the same dad and I'm married to him, but I can still feel the questions that they might ask themselves. Because you see it a lot. People are searching for love, searching for something within, not being alone. And you have to have faith that God will fill that loneliness.
For WMRA News, I'm Kara Lofton.
We'll step a little farther into the Wayback Machine now with a couple of stories we've aired in recent months reflecting two sides of opinion regarding Dominion Power's proposed Atlantic Coast Pipeline. First, a unique group of opponents who are taking to the skies. Late last year, WMRA's Andrew Jenner went along for the ride with a group calling itself the Pipeline Air Force.
Clear below 1,000 temperature, okay. 10 Celsius, dew point.
The air's a little rough, but the view is magnificent from a few thousand feet above the Shenandoah Valley. Michael Godfrey steers his tiny plane, an M7 Mall, west across Augusta County, through Jennings Gap and up over Shenandoah Mountain, following a line on his GPS that traces the proposed route of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. A consortium led by Dominion, one of the country's largest energy companies, is proposing the 550-mile pipeline to transport natural gas from West Virginia to Virginia and North Carolina. Frank Mack is communications manager for Dominion Transmission, a subsidiary that would build the pipeline.
There's a huge need for additional natural gas infrastructure. It's going to help companies like Duke Energy and Dominion Virginia Power with meeting new air emission regulations because they're going to be replacing a lot of their coal plants with natural gas.
In and around the valley, this would be a 42-inch line. That's big, bigger even than the controversial Keystone XL pipeline. And its potential impacts on things like property values and the environment have gotten a lot of people very worked up.
I care about the fact that it's coming through my community and that it will be impacting private property and lifetime investments of the people that live there.
Rick Webb is a retired environmental scientist from the University of Virginia who lives in Highland County, a few miles from the proposed route. He's also a coordinator of the Dominion Pipeline Monitoring Coalition, made up of a dozen organizations opposed to the project. In October, Dominion filed its first documents with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the agency with ultimate oversight of the pipeline. Dominion hopes to start building it in 2016 and start using it by the end of 2018.
We're looking to make the best route with the least impact to the environment, the cultural and historical resources.
Here's the problem. People like Webb say that whatever this least impact is, it'll still be too much for this special place. The two sides simply disagree on what's possible. With careful planning, Dominion says, the pipeline can coexist with these mountain ecosystems. But to Webb, that's trying to have cake and eat it too.
They cannot bring a pipeline through the central Allegheny Highlands without significant damage to the environment.
If the Atlantic Coast Pipeline is approved, it'll be subject to oversight from dozens of local, state, and federal agencies. That's little comfort, though, to Webb and others who don't have confidence in those regulatory agencies either. Which brings us back to Michael Godfrey and his airplane.
I've never seen that before. Let's check it out. We'll check it out.
Godfrey is one of four pilots that have mustered to form the Pipeline Air Force, the aerial branch of the Pipeline Monitoring Coalition.
The idea is to establish an unprecedented level of observation and surveillance for the construction and maintenance of this pipeline if it occurs. The prospective contractors who build this pipeline for Dominion need to understand that they are going to be held to the letter of the law.
In the meantime, they're also lining up the legal team to help compel enforcement of those laws, if it ever comes to that. And so, the Air Force and the rest of the Pipeline Monitoring Coalition aren't just taking on Dominion, widely regarded as the most powerful economic and political entity in Virginia. They're also going up against Virginia itself, and they're ready to take the fight to the skies.
It is a David and Goliath kind of idea. Some may consider it quixotic, but you have to do what you can in behalf of your way of life and your community.
Sure, be in a pattern of shelter. What's your position, please, sir?
For WMRA News, I'm Andrew Jenner.
Now, the other side, on the ground, in places where the pipeline is meeting much less resistance and even open arms, places such as Buckingham, Cumberland, and Prince Edward counties.
If you spend any time around elected leaders in small rural communities, you'll probably hear the following two words a lot: economic growth.
When you mention Buckingham County, a lot of people don't know where it is. It's a great place to have a business. I wish we could get more people here. It's very tough.
Donnie Bryan is a second-grade teacher and a member of the County Board of Supervisors. When he found out that Dominion wanted to build a huge natural gas pipeline straight through Buckingham County, he saw opportunity.
I look at it from the standpoint of the growth in the county. With natural gas, you can grow as a county. You can have businesses come in because the majority of businesses today want natural gas. It's very competitive to get a business to come to your county. And if they have certain criteria that they want, and if you don't meet it, they're going to skip you and just go right down the list.
The Atlantic Coast Pipeline would be an open access line. That means communities along the route could tap into it and potentially use the gas to grow their economies. Last July, Bryan and the other Buckingham supervisors passed a resolution in support of the project. That also happened next door in Prince Edward County, where Wade Bartlett is the county administrator.
It would give us the only opportunity that we have to avail ourselves of the natural gas. Right now, economic development projects are overwhelmingly looking for natural gas, and we have none to provide them at this time.
Electric plants in Virginia and North Carolina would be the pipeline's main customers, and they've already bought 91% of the gas it would transport. The remaining 9% may not sound like much, said Dominion spokesman Frank Mack, but that's 9% of a huge total capacity, 1.5 billion cubic feet of gas per day.
There's plenty of gas to be able to be tapped off of this pipeline. Then we continue to communicate with lots of counties and cities along the route about potential economic development. We have, I think, a large and growing group of supporters for this project.
According to Peggy Bouchard, that support isn't as widespread as Dominion says.
I don't think anyone is happy about it, but the presumption is that it takes vast resources to fight somebody like Dominion. People are afraid that they wouldn't have the money to make it happen. I've had lots of folks reach out and say, man, keep up the good fight. We can't fight, but maybe you can stop it.
Bouchard has refused Dominion permission to survey and anticipates that the company will take her to court.
We love our farm. We work hard on our farm. We don't want the pipeline through the property at all.
That's a perspective that Buckingham County Supervisor Donnie Bryan understands.
I certainly wouldn't want it to come through my backyard, and I do sympathize with the people that it goes through. However, we also talked with the county attorney, and whether we said yes or no to the pipeline, it's going to happen. That's my feeling. It's going to come through somebody's property. Dominion is going to compensate the people for it. Certainly, I sympathize, but if it does go through their property, then it's up to them to work the best compensation that they can from Dominion, and I strongly urge them to do that.
You'll never please everybody, Bryan says, but considering his county on the whole, he thinks that there's a lot more to be gained from the Atlantic Coast Pipeline than there is to lose. For WMRA News, I'm Andrew Jenner.
Now to Martha Woodruff's conversation with Perry Shank, who teaches music at Smithland Elementary School in Harrisonburg, and that includes getting kids to create their own electronic music. It's this week's installment of The Spark.
I think roller derby is a hopeful thing.
He earned enough money from selling plants that he paid off the mortgage on his house.
People always want to know, is that a lie or is that the truth?
I completely disassembled this Triumph TR6.
I wish I could have been a professional woman soccer player.
I'm Martha Woodruff, and this is The Spark, an exploration of interesting people doing interesting things. First things first. All the music used in this edition of The Spark was created by students of Harrisonburg's Smithland Elementary School, where tall, strapping, 30-something father of four, Perry Shank, is the music teacher.
Basically, it's a general music curriculum. So teaching kids how to read time, understand time signature, read notation on a page, being able to play some instruments like the traditional recorder and some ORF instruments, understanding the bar.
ORF
instruments. So that's the barred xylophone instruments.
Things you whack.
Right. Yeah. And we got a lot of those things. Kids love just whacking instruments. And we do a fair bit of singing and music listening. And I really enjoy the science of music. So we talk a good deal about vibration and how musicians take vibration and they shape it. And that's how we become musicians, is that we look at vibration in an artistic kind of way.
From what I can tell, Perry Shank reaches out to students where they live through the use of electronics and all that banging stuff, his goal being to get them to experience music. And this involves moving to music in ways that I, as an aging unhip fuddy-duddy, had never heard of. We're now going to talk about tutting.
Okay.
I think we ought to start, because when Matt Bingay told me about this, I said, what? So what is tutting, and how did you come across it?
Tutting is a form of dancing that is not dissimilar to breakdancing and the style of breakdancing known as King Tutting. The originator of that is Mark Benson, a.k.a. King Tut. It's all these angular movements to the music. It moves with the beats, kind of like a robot, you know, like something moves and then it changes perspective and then
You're doing it now.
Yeah, it changes into something else. It's just really intriguing to watch, especially someone who I did not grow up doing any kind of dance whatsoever.
So how did you first see this?
So there was a Samsung commercial that I saw on YouTube. I was doing some sort of search for music, but this guy started moving to the music, and instead of it being a full body thing, he was sitting at a table, sort of like how I am now, and he would move his fingers and his hands and his wrists and his arms and just created this wonderful thing that was much more than a commercial. It led me to look more closely at that style of dance and to find a whole subgenre of breakdancing called finger tutting. The form of tutting's been around for a lot longer than just a few years. So it's the idea that King Tut brought, Mark Benson King Tut, not ancient Egypt King Tut.
Not the original.
Not the original. Yeah, brought all of those angular movements into just working with the fingers and the hands. Like, you can still do some cool things with the rest of your body, but the focus is on the hands.
Which, when I looked at videos, look as though they have no bones.
Yeah, it's just very fluid. There are several different parts. One of them is the rolls, your fingers open and close, and it's very fluid. And then there's the angles and any work with the fingers. It's called digits. It's such an expressive way of dance that is kind of accessible to all kids. I've found that even though there are some kids that jump into it a lot more readily than others, all of my students have been able to do at least some form of finger tutting. I'm always looking for things to inspire kids, ways to bring music to them in a different way. It's definitely in the context of their normal modus operandi, I guess. You know, they're very much involved in current culture and very much looking for outside of the box things, intriguing things, things that catch their eye. And so when I first saw the video, the commercial video for Samsung, I said, my kids will love this. How could I teach this? And the barrier, of course, that first presented itself was, I need to learn how to do this.
Yes.
So my teammates and I actually sat down and we worked on it a little bit, and we looked and I went through a bunch of tutorials about how to get started. And there's a ton of resources on YouTube these days
about
finger tutting that will take you step by step through what to do for different moves. And then after that, once you've developed the muscle memory, it is all about routine.
So did being you able get to credit for continuing ed for doing this with your YouTube videos?
No, not really.
What a shame. Okay, please continue.
Yeah. So yeah, it's really accessible for kids, and it's something that they're interested in. And so the final part after teaching them the moves is to get them to line it up with music that we listen to. You know, throwing on some instrumental dubstep or something that is really mechanical sounding.
What's a dubstep?
Dubstep. It's the, oh my goodness. It's very, it's electronic. It's dance music that just sounds like a transformer looks.
Okay.
And so having the students listen to that music and listen for the strong beats and then listen to how the music changes and thinking about how what they're doing with their hands might fit into that is kind of the context for how I taught finger tutting or how I teach it.
So they're choreographic.
Yes, they are. And that's part of the standard from Virginia Department of Ed for music is understanding routine and understanding choreography, both traditional and I guess this would classify as non-traditional. It's only for fourth grade.
Only for fourth grade.
Yeah, the other kids know about it and they learn it from their siblings. And every year I get students who have already tried a few routines into my classroom. Now that I've been doing it, well, it's at Smithland, I've been doing it for, this is my third year now. The kids this year already kind of knew about it because I always show the finger-tutting video that I created for our winter assembly that we have right before winter break.
I was going to say, is there a performance?
There is, yeah. But besides putting it on YouTube, I mean, I really enjoy being able to put it out there for anyone to view. And it's interesting, I pulled up the stats for our video in class probably in January to have the kids look at it and see where they connected to with this video. It's just all over the world. And they were astounded that somebody in another country somewhere watched them do finger tutting. And, you know, we get comments on it every once in a while, or somebody sends me an email saying, hey, it was pretty cool to see that finger tutting with such young kids keep on doing it. I would say that my classroom isn't necessarily the traditional music classroom beyond just tutting like things. We cover the basics as well and some of the traditional things like recorders and other instruments and drumming. We've also recently been getting into the use of DJ equipment in my classroom. My students do a lot of popular music creation in my class too, using iPads. And so kids, while they're creating their own music, they experience the music through being a part of it and creating it. And so they start to listen to music more in their surroundings.
The Smithland Elementary School DJ Club, under the encouragement of Perry Shank, will be part of next Friday's Harrisonburg's Park Jam. You'll find a link to that event, plus links to finger tutting and other relevant festivities, on the Spark page at WMRA.org.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our coverage possible, comes from Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus, Janet Trentner, Joy Loving, Rory and Jamie Kutaya, Jim and Pam Huggins, and an anonymous donor. You'll find stories from the WMRA newsroom and more information at our website, WMRA.org. Be sure to like us on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio for a heads up on our coverage. And you can follow me on Twitter at WMRA Bob. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and Morning Edition host. I'm off tomorrow, but I'll be back on Tuesday. See you then.